Okay, welcome again, and thank you for coming to the third of our Open Spaces Spatially Thinking seminars. These are all run on a model of bringing together an external and an internal speaker in order to provoke us and maybe some other people to think through some hopefully shared matters of concern. So the matters of concern that we're addressing this time is either spaces of and for nature or materials in the space of politics, depending on which flyer you read, I think. And we're very lucky to have with us two people, Dr. Andrew Barry from the School of Geography and Environment at the University of Oxford, Dr. Steve Hinchliffe from Open Space, whose work has been instrumental in challenging us over the last decade or so to reconsider our assumptions about the difference that things of all sorts make theoretically, practically, politically, and ethically. Okay, one of the things that distinguishes their writings has been that far from kind of simply transporting into geography an existing set of concepts and problematics from science and technology studies that were kind of designed to address such issues there, they've served to kind of transform those ideas such that it's become increasingly clear that geography and geographers have something distinctive to add to broader debates around materialities currently taking place not only in geography and STS, but also in international relations, in the kind of biopolitics crowd, political theory, thinking kind of Jane Bennett, Bill Connolly's work, philosophy. There's this kind of amazing dialogue going on in the blogosphere at the moment between Graham Harman, who's started an amazing object-oriented philosophy blog, and some of the kind of speculative realists, and it's just a kind of a wonderful thing to behold. And so the sort of questions that Andrew and Steve have been kind of asking us are things like where does the world get done? How do practices space the world in particular ways? What happens when different topologies generated by such practices interfere with each other in specific instances of thrown togetherness, as Doreen calls it? And which versions and shapes of the world become more or less possible in practice and practices? Now, even if they do recognise those questions in any way, and Steve looking slightly dubious, I'm sure that both Andrew and Steve will be the first to say that there are no general answers to them, and certainly one of the key features of the style of work that they're doing is that it's resolutely empirical theorising, in Anne-Marie Mould's sense of the term. So what specifically have Andrew and Steve been working on and thinking through? Well, you might know Andrew's work through a series of significant interventions he's made around Foucault in Political Reason, Technological Economy, and Gabriel Tard and the edited collections of those names, and particularly his book titled Political Machines, Governing a Technological Society. More recently, he's been working on interdisciplinarity with Marilyn Strathern and Georgine Bourne, and the political materialities of oil, which I think is going to be his starting point today. Steve, as many of you will know, has published work alone and with others emerging from projects on the BSE crisis, what habitable cities might involve, reconstituting natures, and the making of biosecurities, and has articulated a broader argument for closer attention to natural geographies as well as natural history in his monograph, Geographies of Nature, available at all good bookshops, I believe he told me to say. He's currently working on a project hosted in Development Policy and Practice, I think run by Les, who's here, on cooperative research on environmental problems in Europe, which is obviously CREPE, and is hoping that the ESRC fund him, John, Simon Carter from Sociology, and myself to do some more work on biosecurity borderlands. Okay, that's enough from me, so I want to hand over to Andrew, who's going to speak for about 20-ish minutes.
Yeah, but please do interrupt me. And I guess most people will have read the paper, but I'm happy to elaborate both on the paper and also on the wider study, because this is a very particular, tiny part of a larger study, though the question of whether it's tiny or not, of course, is part of what the paper is about. So the larger study is about the politics of oil, broadly, but central to that is a case study on the politics of the Baku Tbilisi Ceyhan oil pipeline, which runs from just south of Baku on the Caspian Sea to Ceyhan on the Turkish Mediterranean coast, and was explicitly designed for geopolitical reasons. And there's a lot of literature in IR geopolitics about the background to its construction, which is about how it was necessary for the West the United States in particular, for reasons for energy security, to establish a corridor which avoided Russia and Iran in order to extract energy resources from Caspian and Central Asia, and in return to channel back practices of good governance and transparency to the region along the same route. A very narrow corridor, in fact. I think this issue will, of course, become reopened again with the recent crisis around gas in Ukraine, which is itself a kind of a further complex issue which would require much further discussion. But there are certainly moves to build a gas pipeline through Georgia. So Georgia is seen as an energy corridor. In the literature, in IR geopolitics, it was seen as a moderately unproblematic energy corridor, although there were some troublesome conflicts in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, Nagorno-Karabakh and Eastern Turkey, which the pipeline would undoubtedly have to circumnavigate, and circumnavigate it did, and largely its route is determined by the need to wend its way around a number of little ethnic conflicts, which doesn't mean that ethnicity is not unimportant to the pipeline. That's not something I'm going to talk about today. It was the largest engineering project in the world at the time of its construction in 2003-05. The Department of International Development received more correspondence about this pipeline from NGOs than the Iraq War during the same period. It's a big object, but it's made bigger because both for those who proposed it and those who opposed it, it had enormous significance as a solution to Western energy security problems on the one hand, as a vehicle for the highest levels of corporate social responsibility and transparency on the part of BP and the international financial institutions, secondly, but also for NGOs opposed to the pipeline, it was seen to be a kind of actual test case for the failure of these institutions to develop something which would be of any real benefit to local people or would be environmentally sustainable or whatever. So part of this study is about how what is big object, after all, becomes hugely magnified, and where it becomes hugely magnified, and for what purpose. And initially, I have to say that I didn't conceive of it in these ways. Initially, I thought that the study was a study of, in the manner of science and technology studies, of how activists gathered facts in Georgia and Azerbaijan about the corporate social responsibility of an oil company. How it's possible to produce knowledge about something as strange and obscure as this in not an easy environment to conduct research in. So this is a case study, but it's also a case study which is questioning the idea of a case study, because a case study suggests that one knows the context within which the case is a case of, where precisely what is at issue here in the debate is what this case is about, what wider political significance it has. And I think this has something to say about politics, that in a sense, in politics, the question of what the significance, of the general significance of the particular is itself at issue. In a sense, this is a study which replays an older, very classical concern in social theory about the relationship between macro and microstructure and agency and so on, but the question of what the macro is itself contested. It's in play. And actually, in the wider project which I'm writing on this, I'm also looking at the constitution of, if you like, the larger problems with which this particular case is brought into play with. including the problem of the resource curse and the wider problem of transparency versus corruption in the region. So within this, and this this paper is concerned with a very particular, very limited part of, well, sort of limited part of this controversy, concerned with a controversy about a specific coating material which happened to fail in eastern Georgia. Can you flick that on again? In the region of the city of Rastavi, which is about 20 kilometres to the southeast of Tbilisi. If you go back, that's the city of Rastavi we just saw. These are other things which I will try and explain. Okay, there's Rastavi. It happened. We can pause it. It happened in the early period of the laying of the pipeline in Georgia, in a region which is fairly flat, as you can see. It was much of the pipeline route was across fairly mountainous country. During the winter of 2003-04, actually at the same time as decisions were being made by international financial institutions and the UK government about the funding of the pipeline, and at the height of the debate in which it was going to be a height of NGO activity against that funding. As you can see, this city of Rastavi, which is probably about the size of Milton Keynes, I would guess, but is basically is devastated, economically devastated by the closure of the MiG aircraft factory, which it was constructed in order to house the workers of. And workers from Rastavi themselves were working on the pipeline at the time of these failures in the pipeline coating material, the material which covers the joins between sections of the pipe. And initially, when I heard about this dispute, actually, I really rather ignored it. I thought, this cannot be a seriously significant issue. I remember once in Tbilisi, an environmental NGO called Green Alternative, which was very closely linked with Western NGOs, told me that I should go to photograph sections of the pipeline near Rastavi. And I didn't think this would be a very interesting thing to do. I had other things that I needed to do that day, and so I decided that the difficult drive out to Rastavi, and I'd had a near-death experience previously visiting this city a couple of nights previously. So I avoided, I didn't do that. I never saw an actual pipeline with a proper crack of the kind described in the paper in the field. But they undoubtedly did exist. And this issue became interesting because, as I say in the paper, it becomes one of only two issues out of a vast number of issues raised elsewhere which become discussed in front of the House of Commons Trade and Industry Committee, I think, at that time, which is significant because the DTI's Export Credit Guarantee Department was helping support the construction of the pipeline. So this is an extraordinary part of the story. Part of the paper is about why these particular cracks, which occurred in November, December 2003, become the only issues which really are debated within the House of Commons subsequently, even though this is, as we know now, after Ukraine and after the South Ossetia crisis, this is a pretty geopolitically rather important pipeline, and it's not just important because of the existence or lack of existence of a few cracks in pipeline coating material. But this was the issue which was addressed in great detail by MPs, and there's quite a large dossier of papers about that which is available on the House of Commons website. What's interesting, as I mentioned in the paper, and thinking of, and I mention it because of the workers of Rastavi, one of the reasons why I had been to Rastavi was to meet residents who were complaining that they weren't getting enough compensation from the construction of the pipeline, but also to meet some workers who'd been involved in an unofficial strike action against the subcontractors of BP for low wages, poor working conditions, and so forth. And I'd met the Georgian trade unions earlier in Tbilisi who wanted to know how to deal with this issue. And the curious thing is that actually this issue, one might say, the issue of the wages of pipeline workers, in some ways was just as one could say was just as politically significant as the issue of the cracks, in that the reason why there was a question about workers' pay and so forth, and the kind of details of that dispute, was that as part of the host government agreement between BP and the Georgian government, in effect, Georgian labour law no longer operated along the length of the pipeline. There was a kind of neoliberal exception, if you like, so that, and there are kind of, from the point of view of BP, perfectly good reasons for that, but of course it allows the contractors to work at a higher rate and so forth. But it also, because the Georgian labour law stipulates some maximum working hours, leave for public holidays, no work on Sundays, etc. But also because BP certainly did not want any delays involved in which would have get them any in any relation to what were knowingly understood as the corrupt Georgian legal system. So having striking workers having recourse to Georgian legal system would have certainly been a disaster to a project which was running inevitably to a strict timescale. So, but at the same time, the OECD guidelines for multinational enterprises stipulate that companies should not try to attempt to or be given any exemptions from local law. So clearly BP was breaking the OECD guidelines, and this was known by the British government, who clearly didn't really want to talk about it very much. But it was not picked up by NGOs who concentrated on the issue of the SPC 288. I could say why I think that is, but I mean there are very contingent reasons partly, but partly it's about class in the sense that the Georgian workers were very, Georgian trade unions and workers were not English speakers, whereas the environmental and human rights NGOs were generally university educated and highly connected with Western NGOs. So there's a kind of little story there about what kinds of materials become political. But the other part of the other thing interesting me about the case was the ways that it brought Brent. I was thinking of Brent Spar actually. which I could say something about later, how it brought metallurgy into the field of politics. Metallurgy, broadly understood as all those kinds of disciplines, fields concerned with the study of the properties of metals and other materials connected to metals. And the reason why I'm sort of rather interested in metallurgy is firstly because I think a certain long-standing irritation on my part at the overuse of the metaphor of flow in social theory and the thing about fluids, I think I probably say in the paper, is that they aren't particularly fluid. They're kind of rather solid. If you kind of land at a heart, if you try and smash into a kind of fluid substance, it will feel very hard. Whereas solids are actually incredibly fluid, particularly solids like metals, which involve a huge number of impurities, dislocations, and so forth. So there has to be a kind of sort of give in a metal, which is maybe absent in a fluid. So I'm interested here. Perhaps I think part of the impulse of this paper comes from, is rather similar to the work of Isabel Stengers, whose philosophy I think derives as much from her training in physical chemistry as from any reading of Deleuze and Whitehead. Indeed, I think she is very much a physical chemist who has a very Popperian notion of scientific method as well, though I wouldn't want to defend that here. Though in a way this is a kind of Popperian test case. It's a way in which the NGOs and the oil company are both using a particular case to make a general point and seeking to refute the other's arguments through a particular case. Secondly, crucially, I think metallurgy is an interesting example of a science which is necessarily concerned with the irreducibility of the case. So it's a science which both draws upon general physical principles but certainly resists any reduction to physics or to chemistry. That actually it provides, if you like, therefore, for me, a kind of model of a form of practice in which the question of the irreducibility of the case is in play, in which the example makes a difference, in which the example is not always subsumed under the name of the general. The complexity of the materials in this case are made greater because the oil company is not just involved in constructing a material object, it's involved in constructing what I call an information material object. That it's as much concerned with the construction of the information or material environment of the object, including something like 10 levels of monitoring, some of which are ongoing, involved in the creation of stakeholder groups who will provide continual information about the state of the pipeline or the degrees of its environmental consequences and so forth. So it's literally that the oil company, particularly in this case, had to do something which it might not have had to do at the same level of complexity, which is to construct something which is simultaneously information and material, in which the material, in which there is continual production of new information about that object. So there's that. And part of the kind of political story here is the ways in which conventional political actors, and this is the kind of obviously science and technology studies story, how conventional political actors, the Parliament, the UK Parliament, and the NGOs really don't know, I think, how to deal with the problem of metallurgy. The metallurgy isn't reducible to politics as it's conventionally understood. The metallurgist is engaging in a political act in revealing a problem which had been half covered up, but it's not political in the sense that it can be easily enrolled as being simply for or against the oil company. So the politics of metallurgy are over politicized and the political importance of mortality is therefore lost. Fourthly, I think what's going on in this paper is an investigation, although I don't talk about it in these terms in the paper, of what, I don't know whether how many of you have read Alfred Gell's book, Art and Agency, where he talks about abduction, the kind of the derivation of generalities from the particular, and art objects he reads. An art object, he argues that art should be not be understood in terms of its aesthetic properties, but in terms of the ways in which it is experienced as being the product of social agencies, which may be spirits, they may be ancestors, they may be real artists. And it seems to me that there's a kind of interesting way in which particular technological objects do function in this way. I mean, I think Brent's bar is interesting in that case, that actually Brent's bar becomes a kind of art object, if you like, once it's occupied by a Greenpeace. And I'm not saying, not arguing for or against this action just by saying that, but saying that actually part of what's going on is that the Greenpeace have the amazing capacity of making the particular object stand in for a general problem. And one can't understand this simply as a kind of scientific act or simply a political... So there's a way in which this this is a kind of artistic practice in Gell's sense of the terms, and I think this is going on here. The way in which critics of the pipeline, I think, sometimes effectively, sometimes not, sometimes with more justification and sometimes not, made particular objects into stand-in for general problems. And the same is true of the oil company, for that matter, which is continually in the business of making particular examples of its practice stand in for general examples of its ethics and responsibility and so on. So there's a kind of curious combination of scientificity and artistic practice here, which is rather interesting. I think fifthly, I suppose implicitly, I'm arguing, Doreen mentioned we met earlier at a meeting organised by Chantal Mouffe, in which Bruno Latour was speaking, and perhaps sort of alluding to Chantal Mouffe, this is an argument really, a paper which could be seen as about the specificity of the political. And I'm rather resistant to the move. You mentioned the kind of empirical theory of Anne-Marie Moll. I'm resistant to Anne-Marie Moll's claim for a kind of generalized ontological politics, which seemed to evacuate politics of any particular content. Now, without wanting to define what politics is, I'd rather like to say that politics is a rather specialized kind of activity, or rather particular activity which emerges in particular ways, that doing politics requires a lot of work, and some organizations are better at it than others, and what is going on here is a particular kind of political work which is only partially successful. So I think it's an overuse of ontological politics, just as Foucault overused the notion of power in the power/knowledge idea. So that's roughly what I can show you lots of lovely pictures, but maybe people want to talk about it.
Thank you, Andrew. I think what we will do is to see if there's any immediate questions, see if you get a kind of conversation going, and then we'll kind of move on to Steve as and when.
What is at stake in terms of why raise the issue as of significance in the relationship between the general and the particular?
I think I could give many answers to that question, so it's a slightly difficult one to answer. I do think there's a general problem, a particular problem, whatever. Okay, you know. A problem which exists, which has existed for a long time, of how empirical work is understood, actually. And science and technology studies was
was, I'm using the past tense, science, technology, science is interesting in the sense of making detailed empirical inquiries, doing a kind of empirical set of theory, empirical philosophy. Though, for me, has, in many of its forms, has weaknesses in being narrowly empirical or not wanting to, you know, sticking with the micro example, and also conceiving of what its general significance is, primarily in philosophical terms. After all, a lot of the important work in STS from laboratory life onwards has been, in effect, a critique of the philosophy of science and its generalities. Okay. And actually, one of the things which I'm trying to do here is also sort of argue for, how can I put this, kind of a rethinking of the importance of I'm going to be trapped in the kind of language of specificity and generality. But, you know, it's the reason why I went to Georgia and Azerbaijan is not because it was a case in environmental politics or oil politics, but because I thought it was important. You know, this has a kind of... and it was clearly acquiring a general, even global, importance. So the question of the general has to be understood historically, politically, geographically, not something which is just understood as a kind of philosophical problem. So part of what's at stake here is restoring a belief in the importance of the particular and not seeing the particular either as a kind of solution to a general philosophical problem, though that's a legitimate thing to do, I just think it's not particularly interesting to me, or a solution... or something which is just area studies or something like that.
But there isn't any relation, just to follow slightly, because you talked about area studies, so there isn't any necessary relation between the particular and the local.
No.
Right, okay.
No. And though, first of all, I don't want to simply knock area studies, because it seems to me that actually... And of course, there are many things going on here which it would have been very helpful for me to know about and to understand what was going on. But there just was no real scholarship on Georgia, period. I mean, there's a few books. I mean, there's not very much, actually. Well, and certainly very little on Azerbaijan. But... of course, what BP were doing was creating its own kind of area, explicitly so, a 1,760-kilometre long area, and one which was connected to London, Washington, and so forth. So that's what it's partly about, trying to create, demarcate this space within an otherwise kind of what was regarded as kind of corrupt, kind of unstable environment of Georgia and Azerbaijan. Well, I think it's the story which is, you know, routinely given is good enough. You know, that actually there's a kind of, it comes out of a belief that through using such an account, one kind of is breaking down boundaries, all these kind of things which are regarded as non-existent anymore, identities which non-existent anymore, and territories and so forth, which is fine, but some things are harder than others. And some organisations, oil companies included, are quite good and very effective in creating things which are not particularly flowing. Yet there is movement in them. It's just not... I find it's a very obscuring metaphor to thinking about actual differential forms of, you know... stickiness of resistance of things to movement and so forth. So, and as I said, I think one can both say things... another way of putting it is, actually, things often stay the same by changing all the time. I mean, if you like, this is a pretty 101 version of what capitalism is, you know, staying the same by. But and actually, that's true of companies or oil pipelines. You know, they don't stay the same by staying the same. They stay the same by changing. So I don't think flow is terribly useful.
Yes, earlier you mentioned that this campaign, and perhaps NGO campaigns in general, focus on a particular aspect in order to highlight some wider issue.
Yeah.
And this has been made explicit by some commentators in 1999. Deserves more attention exactly how that is done successfully or not successfully. My question is about the technical or technological aspects. Is there anything specific to a technical fault or a technological innovation serving that role, serving as particular focus represents something more general?
Yeah, I think there is actually, and it's a very good question. Well, I was struck in this case, I still use that term, by the number of times I was pointed towards the existence of cracks. Flow through the, put it on the slideshow. This was a bunch of photos which was given to me by Friends of the Earth, Washington, D.C., when they heard that I was interested in the pipeline, because they thought that these were examples of SBC 288 cracks. And they aren't, but they're indicative of the fact that actually there was a general interest in cracks, not just cracks in pipelines, but also cracks in houses, cracks which might happen when geological faults shifted, cracks which might happen because terrorists attacked pipelines and so forth. And I think what's going on here, one thing I think is that the good thing about cracks for politics is you can't accuse a crack of being politically motivated. But in general, cracks exist. You know, you can point to a crack. The political activist can point to a crack existing independently of his or her activity. And so they have political effects because of that.
Objectivity,
exactly. So the politics comes through their objectiveness. The other thing is, I think cracks are the kind of medium-sized defect in objects.
We want the bottle.
There's a lot of bottles in Georgia as well. Cracks are that kind of medium-sized defect in an object which everyone can recognise as a defect. So it becomes a sign of a wider defect. And other sizes of defects may be difficult to conceptualise. It's a very everyday kind of thing.
Social damage.
Yeah, exactly. So those are kind of two observations. And I mean, I think of the Brent Spar case, there wasn't cracks, but I mean a similar, you know, human scale kind of object which was clearly kind of not right, whereas something which was just happening at a molecular level or a much more systemic level would be difficult to work through. And of course individual activists can name or see such things. I was taken on my field work to see quite a few different cracks, and gradually the problem dawned on me that actually that's what was common about them. They were all cracks, and there wasn't, even if some were really insignificant, some were more significant, some of them didn't exist and some of them would exist in the future, and some were really unknown unknowns and so forth. But yeah,
narratives.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, they then became the objects of regulatory activity by the World Bank and other international institutions who investigated them to determine whether they were particular examples of the general or just particular examples.